So welcome, seriously welcome. I know it's been a long conference. I know it's a long day. Really good to see everyone here, and I'm excited about our presenters and our presentation this afternoon. So here's how we would like to do it. We'll give each presenter about 15 minutes to give their talk, with 5 minutes after for questions to try and be as interactive as we can, which should allow a couple minutes at the end for questions of the whole panel. Does that sound like a fair approach? Super. Okay, so without further ado, let me introduce Michael Schopscher from San Francisco General Hospital and the University of California, San Francisco. He's been doing research in this area for 18 years or so, correct? Michael, thank you.
Well, hello everyone. I don't know, is this mic actually working? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You know, in my spare time, I teach at UC Berkeley, and there's like more students, you know, really I have more students than any of you, so I think I'm going to be just a little bit more informal. I'm a clinical psychologist, a psychological scientist, and Kim Hoffman was really originally supposed to be the first author on this, and she's the only member of the author team that is in public health. I'm a clinical trials researcher, and I tend to study treatments. My own treatment is a cognitive behavioral anger management treatment. And for years, I should say that my mother's from the Philippines, my father's Irish, and I am a biracial researcher. That's why I'm interested in health disparities. I won an affirmative action fellowship to UC Berkeley for my PhD. And for years, I worked with my African-American colleagues on my anger management treatment, and there's sort of just a little bit, you know, of a joke where, of course, it isn't the case that African-Americans, that's an issue for anger management, but cocaine use, the kinds of things we were doing back then, you don't have to say it, but it's implied. When you say that Asians have a substance use problem, people start to go, really? Is that the case? And so I decided what might be very interesting is, you know, just one last thing. There was an epidemiologist in San Francisco, and he was giving a talk to our group, and he said, you know, the only group that's increased in the rate of substance use are Filipinos and methamphetamine use. And I thought, whoa, for the first time, an Asian group actually is possibly having a problem. So I got some other people together, and we came up with this. I just want to say that this is funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Clinical Trials Network, and the PIs of the two nodes involved in this are the Western States node, Dennis McCarty at Oregon Health and Science University, and Dr. James Sorensen at UCSF, and also by the Pacific Region node, Walter Ling. Dr. Walter Ling is the PI at UCLA for that node. So, those of you who may not be familiar with this, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are the fastest growing group in the United States. Some say the fastest growing group, but I'm going to hedge my comment a little bit. They're a heterogeneous group. They speak many different languages. There's many different ethnicities. About 67% of Asian Americans are foreign born. Now, it's important to kind of point out that Asian American as a group is kind of a misnomer. It covers a lot of different things. And it was decided long ago, sometime in the 60s and 70s, that it might be a better idea to kind of take all the different Asian groups that have a small amount, you know, by themselves and kind of band them together to make one large group. The problem with that from the dominant culture point of view is that people, tend to kind of not realize that, well, there's not really just one Asian group. There's many, many different Asian groups, just like there's many, many different Hispanic groups. There's just many different groups, and you kind of don't want to lump them together. So it's like it's difficult to identify what group you're talking about. And also, there's this idea that psychologists write about called the model minority myth. You know, it is the case that some Asian groups are doing really well in the United States. It turns out that Asian Americans are overrepresented at every level of education, from high school to universities to doctoral degrees, and even among university professors. Now, that can lead to this sort of stereotype or myth that this group's doing really well and it doesn't have any problems. And that may not be true. Yesterday, there was this interesting talk from the API caucus where somebody who studies cancer actually said that there are some of their patients who had cancer who were Asian, and people actually believed that they didn't have cancer, because Asians don't have problems. Asians don't even have cancer. That, of course, isn't the case. Here's just a quick slide to show you some studies to show that Asian Americans, in general, tend to report less drug use, tend to be less likely to meet substance use disorder criteria. Here's an adolescence that shows that. Here's sort of rates of alcohol and drug dependence, where whites, so-called whites, are being compared to APIs. You can see it's a lower rate. Why is this the case? Kind of the leading researcher in substance abuse in Asians is Nolan Zane at UC Davis. He's the director of the Asian American Center on Disparities Research. And he has this theory. He's studied this in San Francisco for a great many years, and he discovered that Asians, in fact, do have low rates of substance use. And he's actually created a study, you know, a theory that said it may be because substance use contradicts or conflicts with immigrant status of Asians to do well. And maybe that's why they use less. Now, and he says instead they might be pathological gamblers, and he's got some data to support that. But nevertheless, we feel in our study that, you know, this group might have substance abuse problems. Another major finding you probably read about is that Asians tend to underutilize healthcare services and substance abuse services. If anything, it might be that they wait a little while for the disorder to get worse before they actually use the services. So this is a very basic exploratory study where we wanted to see if we could find possible barriers. Again, possible and not exhaustive by any means, but just what are some of the possible barriers that substance abuse treatment clients and frontline staff might identify as to why they do not enter treatment? And I should say, the clients, kind of that reflects their own perspective. Why don't I or the people I know enter substance abuse treatment? The providers, on the other hand, they might actually be able to say, talk about trends. Like, this is what I see with most of my clients, why they do not enter substance abuse treatments. This has been studied before in across different ethnic racial groups. And Grant, Appellant, Aldick, they've discovered that, well, here are some of the reasons that people don't, substance use users don't enter treatment. They're not ready for treatment at the personal level. There's shame about revealing their substance use disorders to their family, friends, and coworkers, fear of losing custody. But mainly they argue the system is the reason why people do not enter substance abuse treatment. They don't know how to pay for treatment. They don't know how to get treatment. In our study, we used a variety of treatment settings, and we didn't mean to be comprehensive. This isn't meant to be comprehensive. We went to Daly City, California, which is predominantly Filipino. Actually, that's a city that's right next to San Francisco, and it's said to have the largest number of Filipinos outside of the Philippines. Our colleague Martin Aguchi at UCLA wanted specifically to study Koreans in Los Angeles, so he kind of fixed his sample to that sample. We went 45 miles or so down south to San Jose, which they, along with Orange County, tend to be the largest concentration of Vietnamese speakers. All of our Vietnamese clients spoke Vietnamese only, and we had to do the interviews in Vietnamese. We also studied San Francisco, another program in San Francisco that had more diverse AAPI groups. And finally, Kim Hoffman studied a program on the Big Island of Hawaii, in Hilo, Hawaii, to try to get maybe some of the Pacific Islanders into the group. But mainly she got a lot of native Hawaiians, so that's kind of useful. All of these programs specialize in providing substance abuse treatment. And just quickly, I wanted to tell you about a paper that we published on this, because I wanted to compare the client's perspective that we're going to publish, that's being published in an upcoming Journal of Substance Abuse Treatment article, with what the providers said the barriers were. These were 61 clients. The thing you might note is more of the clients are from the San Francisco Bay Area area, some with Los Angeles and Hilo. We found out that some of the facilitators, which we were aware of, were that Asian Americans were more likely to be mandated by the criminal justice system to enter treatment. 34% decided that they needed treatment at this point, and they came to that decision on their own. 28% had peer support to stop using substances. The barriers to treatment entry, peer pressure to continue using substances, as you can imagine, is a big impediment to entering treatment. Fear of loss of confidentiality, feeling their substance abuse problem isn't bad enough. Fear of a loss of employment, didn't know where to, and again, these are the system variables, didn't know where to get the services, long waiting times to get the services, concerned with how to pay for the services, and didn't believe they were eligible for the services. So again, that's what the clients had said. Now, one of the big issues that a lot of the literature in this area, the clinical literature where clinicians write about this topic, concerned family. So we expected there to be a lot of family issues that were an impediment. And this is the data that we found, which isn't quite what we expected. We thought that face loss concerns, which is a frequent topic, would prevent these individuals from seeking treatment. That was only reported by 10% of the group. The notion that the treatment providers should understand and speak their language, and that was an impediment, that really wasn't brought up by a lot of the people, although it was brought up. Believing that culturally competent treatment was important, that was 15%. Now, perhaps the issue is that these programs had Asian American culturally sensitive treatments, and maybe they had felt like that wasn't an issue for them, or they underestimated the issue. The other big topic was the role of the family. You know, families usually reported as one of the main factors that sort of differentiates Asian groups among Asian clinicians. That may not be true. 23% had brought this up as an issue. A facilitator might be the family saying, you know, we finally have decided to withdraw financial support unless you get your problem under control. Or a barrier, though, could be feeling the need to conceal the problem from people outside the family or within the family. In Hawaii, it turned out, and this only happened in our Hawaii sample, some family members had substance use problems, and that, of course, would hinder treatment because they're using substances, and, of course, they don't want their family, you know, don't encourage their family member to use them as well. Survey responses suggested that family was against 18%, but about half of these were Filipinos in Daly City. Here's the participant characteristics of the provider sample I'm going to report on today. There's slightly more women, but equally distributed between men and women. The majority had a university education. Large proportion had about 5 years or more of substance abuse experience. The San Francisco and Los Angeles staff were mostly API, and the Hawaii staff, though, were not. They're about 40 years old in terms of their age. So we had semi-structured interviews. We gave them to the frontline clinicians. We digitally recorded them. We transcribed them. A first set of quarters read the transcripts. They identified themes through an iterative process of review and revision. That was Kim and Somasen and Nick Hengel on the author list. Then we had a second group of coders try to recode it, and I'm reporting their kind of recoding today. So here's what happened in our findings. 23%, I'll remind you, in our clients said that family issues were a barrier. The providers had a slightly different perspective. They felt a supportive family facilitated treatment entry, but a lot of the main barriers, 58%, were they may not enter treatment because they want to protect the family from shame. The family is trying to conceal the substance use problem from people outside of the family. Then we had this sort of hypothesis that one of our Asian American research assistants kind of came up with, which we call the enabling hypothesis. The notion is that what Asian families might do, and this was about 38% had described this of the providers, what they might do is to conceal the problem, they pay for the substance use patient's living expenses. So they don't have to show the person can't work and they can kind of conceal this idea. Family members deny the person has a problem. It could be that the family members don't have knowledge of SUDs and they have a fear of becoming disowned by the family. Regarding cultural competence, as you can see from this slide very quickly, cultural competence was viewed as a little bit more important by the providers. The providers, I made this specifically, providers suggested that the AAPI clients lacked English-speaking skills and that could hinder treatment. The SUD treatment and an API's client's native language does facilitate treatment is what they thought. Culturally competent treatment staff facilitate treatment. Substance abuse treatment staff is facilitated if the staff are of the same race and ethnicity. Additional factors are API clients enter treatment because they're court referred. That was consistent with what clients had perceived. Peer support to stop using substances was a big issue. Additional barriers could be a few of the patients thought they might become deported, although the clients were less likely to think that than what the providers believed. Employment issues were an issue. Losing job, not being able to go to work was one of the other factors. So obviously, we had a very small sample size. We only looked at publicly funded substance abuse programs. You can't really generalize this, but in this exploratory study, we hope we identified some barriers that we could explore later in larger scale survey research. The implications for treatment are, well, you probably want to involve family members in the Asian community. For substance abuse treatment, you want to look at culturally tailored interventions still. You probably want to have campaigns to kind of tell this community about substance abuse, reduce the stigma, tell them about the problems with substance abuse, and get them to change their attitudes. Also, you might want to recruit at kind of healthcare fairs or festivals and other places where substance abuse isn't normally kind of discussed, but you can introduce the idea to that. Thank you. I mean, did you want, do I have time for questions? Or
yeah, no, absolutely. We have a few minutes for questions. Let me just quickly take moderator prerogative here. Briefly, Michael, in your opening comments, you think made some comparisons around anger management vis-a-vis population. And I don't think you meant to suggest that one population may be more likely.
No. I'm saying that they're not. They're okay, definitely not that. It's just that some people, though, kind of, I think that it's a misperception that you kind of feel that, oh, if you study cocaine, you know, which we were, and anger, then it seems like, well, one population has that versus another. If you study another one, and Asians, again, what I'm trying to say is Asians, there's that sort of misperception that, well, they don't have problems, they don't use services, they don't tend to have the problems other groups do, and that may not be the case. Naturally, it turns out that there really aren't a lot of it's really hard to document racial ethnic disparities, which is something I've worked on across the different racial ethnic groups in substance use disorders. Sometimes people believe that they exist, but sometimes when you control for sociodemographic variables, the so-called differences tend to disappear. Yep. I can't remember. You also want to somehow figure out ways to screen and identify this population. It's very hidden, and we had a lot of trouble. I'll just say one last thing about that, is that, you know, we tried to use snowball sampling in among the in-treatment patients to get the out-of-treatment patients, and it was just very hard to do. We tried for an entire 6 months to get out-of-treatment individuals with the notion that these would tell us why these patients that we studied actually were in treatment. We wanted to actually go out and find, well, what if they're not in treatment? Can they tell us why they don't want to be in treatment? And we could barely find any of them. And we tried with snowball sampling, with incentives, and we had a lot of trouble trying to find participants to do that. And so that's why we were suggesting that, well, you might have to go to fairs, cultural events, and try to go there to change the ideas about. Oh, yes.
Did you find in your ethnic-specific data there were differences in terms of the responses by either on the provider side or on the patient side? It looks like you oversampled.
Yeah, that there are differences I'll just mention a few. In our paper, which is going to come out soon, I like tediously went through and I found the differences. It's easier to do that, of course, in the clients because they say what race ethnicity they are. The providers aren't really clear. They're talking about different race ethnicities, but there are a few different things. Off the top of my head, it seemed like, for example, the Filipinos in Daly City, they seem to be more concerned about a loss of confidentiality, I believe, and it's actually hard to kind of generalize from that. I'm not really sure how accurate that turns out to be. But there are some differences. And it's hard to do with such a small sample. Yeah. Thank you.